All right, welcome into another edition of the Cumming and Gillespie LLP Flames Alumni Chronicles. It's Pat Steinberg along with you, and it's episode 13 of the program as we're finishing off our chat with former executive Al Coates that we started last week. Cumming and Gillespie LLP, personal injury and medical malpractice lawyers committed to getting maximum compensation for the injured and their families. Visit CummingGillespie.com, and we have got lots to get to with Al Coates this week. He was an executive with the Flames in the 80s and 90s, won a Stanley Cup in 1989 to go along with an entire life spent in the sport of hockey. We started the conversation last week, but so many stories still to get to with Al, Brent Cron, and Colin Patterson in just a minute's time. But first, it's time for This Week in Flames History, brought to you by Village Honda. And this week, we're going back 18 years ago this week to June 14th of 2007, when the Flames named Mike Keenan the 15th head coach in franchise history. It was Keenan's 8th head coaching job in the NHL, following stints with Philly, Chicago, the New York Rangers, St. Louis, Vancouver, Boston, and Florida. Keenan would coach 2 seasons with the Flames. He went 88, 60, and 16, made the playoffs both years. Flames would lose in the first round both of those times to San Jose in 2008 and then in Chicago in 2009. So it was 18 years ago this week, June 14th, 2007, when the Flames named Mike Keenan head coach, and that is This Week in Flames History, brought to you by Village Honda, your dealership for life in the Northwest Auto Mall. Okay, let's dive into the conversation. Al Coates, the former executive, former GM of the Flames, in conversation with Brent Cron and Colin Patterson. Let's start listening in right now.
So when the Flames were, you know, they lose in 86, right? When did you see this Calgary Flames team start turning the tide and being a contender? When, you know, you talked about Al McNeil coaching and went to Badger Bob and went to Terry Criss, but at what point in your mind, watching this team for so many years, when did you kind of start to say, hey, this is, we got something here that we can build on?
Well, I guess from my perspective, and that's, you know, one thing Cliff always said to me one time, he only had to say it once, quite frankly, there's only one person makes decisions here, and it's me. So I kind of learned my lesson. I was in the very first year I was on the radio, and I used the word we instead of Cliff. I get a call, and he says, there's only one person makes decisions here. You got it? I said, yeah, I got it. But anyways, to answer your question, I think that, you know, we went through an evolution, and the guys that came up from Atlanta, they were all good guys and unbelievably talented guys. Like, I mean, some of those guys were Guy Chouinard, Eric Vail, Paul Ryan. Some of the guys were Rookie of the Year. They were great, great players. But winning wasn't necessarily front of mind. I mean, they could say it was in Atlanta. They didn't win a playoff round in Atlanta, which I think had a lot to do with the fact the team was made available for sale and ended up here. I mean, they had some playoff success down there. I don't know whether it would have changed things or not, but they didn't, fortunately for Calgary and for me and for lots of people. Anyways, I started to see it when we started to move out, and I won't mention names, move out people that I don't think winning was necessarily front of mind. And brought in maybe somebody maybe a little bit less talented, but committed to winning. You know, I remember when Montreal Canadiens had both Dougie Jarvis and Doug Risebrough and didn't really need both of them. And Dougie Jarvis was the reigning Iron Man of the league at the time, and Riser was made available. You know, when you bring Lanny in from Colorado, couple of years before that, I think it started way back then. You know, that's the greatest trade ever in the history of the franchise, is that trade made by Cliff, not by me.
But we're getting into your trades.
Yeah, but anyways, with Lanny coming in a couple of years later, Risebrough comes in, Mike Eaves comes in, and not necessarily, everybody's a great player that plays in the NHL, don't
For
get
sure.
me wrong, but maybe not the most talented players. but the most committed players, and you started to see an evolution. And then this group of guys comes along, like the college free agent group that
you guys had a bunch of. Until we talked about this, yeah, you got Austin, yeah, McCowan, seven you, guys, yeah, you, yourself,
Eddie Burns, yeah. Charlie Bourgeois. And
Gino Cavallini, Neil Sheehy.
Some of those guys actually, you know, he end up Cliff ends up being able to trade three of those guys for Joey Mullen. Yeah. You know, later on, and type of thing. Like, so you know, now you know what we call that now? Asset management.
Yeah.
So that was a different form of asset management. Acquire players that didn't cost you anything. They didn't cost, like, other than Patterson's big signing bonus.
Yeah.
The other
which
guys,
was what, exactly? Which, how much did you
what's
get?
That? Let's see. It was,
you have a hard time signing that one, Coach? Was, like, yeah, oh, I don't know if we can give it away here.
The 30 Canadians, you know, split over 2 years.
I think my hand is still shaking.
Yeah.
It was like Marion Ilitch signing all the Detroit Tigers salaries every 2 weeks by hand. The hand is shaking.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so to answer your question, I think...
I'm sorry.
Answer your question. I think it started then, and then became a very committed team. Bob Johnson was one of a kind. Nobody's ever seen anything like that in the NHL before, and it kind of spread to some extent through the NHL. And we had the unfortunate. Well, we weren't as good as Montreal in '86, anyways. There was a luncheon, I forget how many years ago, and you know they have the. What do you call it? The hot stove thing, and Carbono was one of the guys up on the stage, and somebody asked him the question. Says like, "What about '86 and what about '89?" He says, "It's really simple. What's wrong with you?" He says to the guy that asked. Yeah. Says, "We were better than them in '86, and they were better than us in '89. Yeah. That's how it happens. That's how you win." Yeah. And he was right. But what happened to us in '86 is that we blew Game 6 in St. Louis. And instead, and Montreal had already beaten Hartford, and had already had 7 days rest, if I'm not mistaken, when we lost Game 6 on Saturday night in St. Louis. Now we got to play Sunday night, right back to back.
Back to back.
I'm pretty sure, right? Back to back.
And we had back to back 7-game series too.
That's right.
Yeah.
So and they're sitting there waiting for us. We lose Game 1 at home after having like a. An impeccable record at home all year, and beat up, and everybody was beat up. And anyway, so they were better. They win, but you learn from that. You get hungrier, and you. I mean, every summer, from as long as I can remember, we would sit around. I'm going back to 1980, 81 now, because players all go home, but you know we don't go home. You know, you sit around. How are we going to get better? That's what you spend your summers doing, and every day during the course of the year, like, what can we do today to get better? And in our case, we had to get better to the point that we could beat Edmonton. If we can't beat Edmonton, we're not going to win. So 86, we won Game 7 in Edmonton. It was like we'd won the Cup, that series. And there was 25,000 people at the airport to greet the team when we came home. Like, for the city of Calgary, it was an incredible experience to beat the Oilers. And then we go on and we ultimately lose. But I think people got a real solid taste of what winning felt like and the jubilation that comes along with that and the respect factor and what you mean to the community and what fans in general and everybody like thinks of you type of thing and your role in the community. So I think it led up to that. 86 was big. 87, if I'm not mistaken, was a 2 out of 3, and we got beat by Winnipeg. Badger leaves, and in comes Crispy. A couple more moves Cliff makes, and all of a sudden we're ready to have a different kind of a coach behind the bench. And we're close friends and always have been. I looked after the Moncton franchise when he was coaching there, and I was a big proponent of him, despite... you know, him being a little tough on people at times. But he was the right coach for us at the right time, in my opinion, it proved to be true. And he was a guy that, in my opinion, didn't get enough credit for being Scotty Bowman-ish, if there is such a term, of intuitiveness, like instinctiveness, like on the bench. And you'd be sitting upstairs in the press box and you're watching the game, trying to watch it very closely, watching the moves, watching the benches, both benches. And something would happen on our bench, and I'd say, "Wow, what are we doing here type of thing. But it would work out. You go down to the dressing room after, what were you thinking? Like, what were you thinking about putting Patterson on with 2 minutes to go? You know?
we're losing.
No. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. But you know what? He wouldn't even know what you're talking about. This is, what are you talking about? I don't remember that. But it was just an instinctiveness, and that Scotty had that. Scotty was two shifts ahead of the guy on the bench right beside him. Like, you know, never mind. Dave Lewis was assistant coach. Never mind them, Louis. That's not who's coming out. Here's who's coming out next. We'll match up against the guy, the line that's coming out after them. Yeah, that's the guys we got to worry about. And that's what great coaches do, is they have a sense and feel for the bench and what to do at the right time.
Absolutely. Now, going through the whole draft process, to interviewing players, sitting down with guys, what was that like? You got to do it a bunch. Is there anything in particular you remember sitting down with certain people, trying to get their character, what makes them tick? What do you value? I was just I've been on the other side of those interviews, you know, sitting in the room and you get bombarded with questions about this, and like, none of this makes any sense. Why are you asking me that? But any recollections you have from your time?
Well, the thing that happens before that is the scouts have done a lot of work. I mean, the draft is for the scouts. The manager may look at something. He's not likely going to overrule the scouts. You during the course of the year, what you try to do or should be doing is addressing team needs. You know, like if you take your team now and you go number two on defense all the way through to 99 and project it out 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years on a spreadsheet, then you're going to see who's falling off. Like, who's going to either retire, not going to be as good 4 years from now as he is today. That's kind of what drafting and scouting, there's a lot to do with that, because it's about projections. In all likelihood, and things have changed a little bit, like with the celebrities of the world, but you're not seeing many guys that are stepping in out of the draft and making an impact. In fact, they would be better served if those players could go to the American League, which only the European guys can do, the North American guys can't do, which is unfortunate. They'd be better served being in the American League if they're too good for junior. And so in most cases, I think they could probably stand another year maybe back in junior. But anyways, to answer your question, like a lot of this homework's been done by the scouts. I was talking earlier about talking to the school teacher, the neighbor, you know, teammates, the trainers, coaches of that player back in junior or wherever type of thing, and getting as much homework as you can done. But that's the scout's job also,
yeah,
to do all that stuff. And then you have your meetings. You have all your meetings to evaluate and create the list. You know, your list one through whatever. You know, I always laughed at Cliff, because Cliff, I remember Cliff one time bringing the hockey news to the draft table, and were the scouts ever mad? They were furious at him. Anyway, but I think you go back to addressing team needs. Hi, Mark. Go back addressing team needs for one thing. Where are you going to be in the, you know, in 2 to 3 years type of thing with your team, and start to fill in holes. Like when I was here, what I tried to do is go. I had a thing called 1-4-6. So if we're going to be successful, we need to have a star goalie. You know, like not an average goalie, but we need star goaltending.
You looked him right in the eyes.
You refined my craft for 9 years in the American League, Coatsy.
No, I wasn't looking at him. Honest. Well, maybe a little.
Yeah.
Anyways,
yeah.
And then four difference makers on defense and two top lines, and then we can fill in the rest type of thing. But it's the only way you're going to be successful is, in my mind, is to create the boxes, fill them in one by one. If you get a chance to fill one of the boxes via trade, like we did, like we traded for Jagera here. That was, he went on to win the Conn Smythe and the Stanley Cup in Anaheim. So that was a box that we didn't have. We traded for Robin Regier, filled another box. Yeah, we traded for Aginla, filled another box. Traded for Mark Savard, filled another box. So if you combine that, You combine that with your combine that with your drafting and get success at the draft table. You look at Dallas. I think in 1 year, the goaltender, who I don't know, there were three or four guys on Dallas team, but they were all stars in one draft. So if you get lucky in the draft, like the Nieuwendyk trade back in. Or sorry, Ken Nielsen trade back in the 80s was end up 2 second-round draft picks. One was Nieuwendyk, the other one was Stephen Matteau.
Wow.
Two second-round picks. So you got to have a little bit of luck with it along the way at the same time.
And then are we getting into a UB and GM right now?
Slowly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Yeah.
So your first trade.
Yep.
Was that the Nui one?
First big trade. I think we'd done maybe. I don't remember to tell you the truth. Like I took over in November, I guess, of that year, and.
But you were left with a bunch of.
Pardon?
You were left with some issues that need to be resolved.
We had a lot of issues. Like first of all, like nobody's making excuses. Like I thought our staff, you know, Pierre was here at the time. Made the playoffs my first year here. But Jerome came in and played the games 3 and 4 of the first round against Chicago. And, well, actually going back to World Juniors in December after making the trade, because that was a tough trade. You're trading a great person and a great player in Joel Nieuwendyk.
And you were the GM then.
I was the GM, yeah. When we did that. So anyways.
So what was the basis behind it?
The basis behind it was because Joe wasn't playing for us. So, I mean, he was under contract, but he came to training camp, and I knew this.
But you would just, like, explain the transition between you and Reiser.
So I was the assistant GM at the time, and so Nui had gone through arbitration that summer, and that didn't go very well, even though he got a decent award, and it went from Canadian to U.S. dollars also. But still, arbitrations are tough, I tell you. They hurt a lot of people. You know, guys, players can say all they want. It's yeah, we understand it. It's part of the business. They don't understand it.
No, for sure.
And if you're going to win an arbitration, you got to come up with a pile of stuff that's not very nice. You know, that's to file, and the guy's sitting there, and I don't care who you are. You know, you've got feelings, you've played your heart out, tail off, whatever, for the organization, and this is what you hear. So it doesn't go over very well with most people, like 95% of the people. And that's why you see so many of them settled the day before or day out or whatever. Management knows that. They really don't want to have to put the player through that because of, you know, the hurt feelings that are going to result of it. Anyway, so that happened. Jane and I go to Toronto, spend the weekend with Joe and Tina, talk about a bunch of things and try to mend some fences and then come back. He says, Coach, I'll come to training camp, but if there's not a change by the end of training camp, I'm gone. And that's exactly what happened. So I ended training camp. He says, I told you what I was going to do, and this is the case. So now you can do one of two things. You can be a hard ass if you want and say, well, under contract, we're not going to pay him, so he can just sit. But that, in my mind at the time, that's not helping the team. You know, so he's not playing for us, and neither is anybody else. So anyway, it took a long time to make that move because, you know, you've got a really valuable player, and as we all know, a great, great person, and Joel Nieuwendyk. So it's not an easy deal to make, despite the fact that everybody in the league would want him. So you think it would be an easy thing to make. But when you've made up your mind, which we had, that the only way this is going to happen, if we're getting an A prospect, can't miss prospect back. I don't care what the rest of the deal is, but the principle has to be a can't miss prospect. In the whole league, we only had 3 teams like that. So we went from 13 teams to 3 and then started working with the 3 and finally made a deal with Dallas. And a deal that really turned out great for Dallas because they won a cup, and it turned out I'd say, fairly well for the Flames franchise for, what, 15, 16 years?
I think it turned out great for the Flames franchise.
Yeah, so anyways.
Coetzee, in the old days, no arbitration.
Yep.
They send you to Chicoutimi.
Yeah.
That was the only thing. They threaten you and send you to the swellest town in Quebec, and then you had to sign with them. Otherwise, you're going there.
Well, the problem is you always found your way home. you're like a homing pigeon. Doug Barkley, it was a great, great player. I don't think you ever had to worry about getting sent to Chicoutimi.
Back in the old days, you had to sign. You didn't have to sign, but they used to send scouts around to come to small teams and small towns. You'd sign a C4.
Yep, exactly.
And every time a scout come into your dressing room as a bantam or whatever, you're going to sign it. So I belonged to Chicago for a long time. I was never going to make it there. So fortunately, I got traded to Detroit. Otherwise, I would have been in Chicoutimi.
Well, it's funny you say that because I jokingly say this. So I grew up on a farm, as I said earlier. I was never a great player like you guys all were. But I was decent. So I always tell the joke that the Boston Bruins came and wanted to sign me to a C form, and the guy says, $500. And my dad says to the guy, says, I don't have $500. So we watched the taillights go back out the laneway.
That's good.
Just kidding.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. So... Was that your first trade?
That was the first big one. I think we made a couple little minor shuffles before that, yeah. But
what was it, Gary Roberts?
Yeah,
when did that sort of?
So it was Gary was still here when Nui was because it was funny because, well, not funny, but he'd come in, you know, because they were like
the
two peas in a pod, right? The two of them. So he'd come in and he says, "What's going on with my pal?" And I said, why don't you do something about your pal and tell him to get his duff back here type of thing. And he says, nah, he's not coming back. Anyway, so what happened was, and I can't tell you exactly the year, but it would be a couple of years after that, so maybe 97, 98. So he started to have these issues with his neck. Do you remember?
Yeah.
So we're in Chicago, and I made arrangements to go over to Ohio to see one of the great specialists, neck and back specialists. I'm trying to remember it wasn't the Mayo Clinic there, but anyways, so we fly over there. Guy says to Rob, says the doctor says, this is not good. Says I don't recommend surgery. And then he says something like, be careful you don't get any hit from behind on the way back to the airport, whatever type of thing. And I said, oh, boy, you know. So anyway, so he was devastated. Gary was, understandably. So I was with him. We get back to Chicago. I said, sit down, we're going to talk about this. So we didn't sit down and talk about it. I said, I'm going to call somebody else. So I called the Watkins Clinic in Los Angeles, Bob Watkins. And it was interesting because you go into this office, he's got... I'm making up names. Joe Namath is on the wall. He's saved his career, and this guy and that guy, all these guys. Anyway, so I tell him the circumstances. He says, bring him out. He says, I think I can probably help him. So away we go again. We go out there. So he has the right side surgically repaired, and he played about, I don't know, 20 games, maybe 25 games, whatever. And then he started to have problems with the other side. And then we had the other side done. And now it comes summertime, and his contract's up. So got a decision to make whether to qualify him or not. I think he was at $2 million Canadian at the time. And so I was big into asset management even back then. I says, I don't want to let a guy like Gary Roberts' value walk away for nothing. But he couldn't play for us anymore because our doctors had signed off. So out on a limb here, he's not going to be able to play for us the following year. So give permission for him to go all over the place. He went to the island. He went various places, San Jose, everybody wanted him. But once they did the medical on him, they didn't want to take a chance. So anyways, between Jimmy Rutherford and Rick Kern, his agent, and myself, we convinced Carolina that, because they were looking for leadership. They were looking for leadership of a young, maybe Skinner at the time, and yeah. Brindamore was there, and I don't know, young guys in Carolina. They were looking for leadership. So they were willing to take the risk, and it paid off. Jeez, I think he played about 300 NHL games after that, or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so the deal that brought Jaguar to Calgary. It was Trevor Kidd and Gary Roberts for Andrew Castles and J.S. Jaguar to Calgary. So again, I mean, that was one of the building blocks.
Yeah.
And good for Robs. I mean, he made the most of it. So he went on and played for Toronto after that. He terrorized the league for, I don't know, how many games do you think? 400 maybe?
I'm going to say 500 more.
Yeah, maybe
even more than that.
After his career was supposed to be over with.
Still terrorizing guys in the alumni games,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just ask, who was it? Chris Draper?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah he took him out. Yeah. Well, because Joe Neuendijk was a general manager in Dallas when I was there, and he brought Gary Roberts in as like a health and fitness specialist. So that scared the shit out of me right pretty quick.
Well, you know, forced a lot of guys out of the game.
There you go. That's part one of this week's conversation with Al Coates, the former Flames executive. Plenty of more stories still to come on this week's edition of the program, and we'll get back to it very shortly. But right now, it is time for this week's edition of Flames Trivia, brought to you by OSY Rentals. Make the best use of your oil field production budget. OSY's Vapor Tight package comes with everything required downstream of the wellhead. Call 1-855-OSY-TANK. And once again, we've got a trivia question centered on Al Coates, who was the GM of the Flames when they traded Joe Neuendijk to the Dallas Stars back in December of 1995. In return, of course, the Flames received the rights to Jerome Iginla and one other player. So who was the other player the Flames got back in the Joe Neuendijk trade? It was Jerome Iginla, and who? We'll give you a few seconds to think of the answer. Well, not our most difficult question ever. If you remember that trade, you probably got this one. The correct answer, Corey Millen was the other player the Flames acquired on top of Jerome Iginla in the Joe Neuendijk trade. Millen would go on to play 92 games over a couple seasons with the Flames, his final two seasons in the NHL, recording 40 points in those 92 games. That is this week's edition of Flames Trivia, brought to you by OSY Rentals. Okay, we are just getting started on this week's edition of the Cumming and Gillespie LLP Flames Alumni Chronicles as our conversation continues with Al Coates, Cumming and Gillespie LLP, personal injury and medical malpractice lawyers committed to getting maximum compensation for the injured and their families. Visit CummingGillespie.com, and the conversation with Al Coates continues around the corner. Okay, welcome back as we continue on this week's edition of the Cumming and Gillespie LLP Flames Alumni Chronicles. My name is Pat Steinberg as our chat with Al Coates continues in just seconds' time. Cumming and Gillespie LLP, personal injury and medical malpractice lawyers committed to getting maximum compensation for the injured and their families. Visit CummingGillespie.com. More great stories still to come with Al Coates along with Brent Cron and Colin Patterson, your host. But before we get back to there, it is time for this week's edition of Where Are They Now, brought to you by Pure Chem Services. And this week we're catching up with former Flames forward Martin Jelena, who was a free agent signing in the summer of 2002. Marty Jelena would go on to play 157 games with the Flames, recording 38 goals and 87 points. And of course, we know how important he was in the 2004 Stanley Cup run. He had three series-winning goals, two of them in overtime, en route to Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final that year. After some time in player development with Nashville after his playing career came to an end, Jelena rejoined the Flames organization as an assistant coach in 2012, and he's been with the organization ever since. Since that time, bunch of seasons as an assistant coach, and now in a player development role with the team, and Marty lives right here in Calgary. Martin Jelena this week on Where Are They Now, brought to you by Pure Chem Services, the expertise to realize higher production and lower costs. Okay, right back into the conversation with Al Coates, the former Flames GM and executive, in conversation with Brent Cron and Colin Patterson. Let's listen in and get right back to it right now.
Were you involved in that whole Toronto trade between the Leafs and the Flames there?
Yep. No, I was. Yeah.
I figured as much.
Yeah, yeah.
How'd that go down?
Not well.
Not well everywhere, anywhere except in Toronto.
Yeah.
it was interesting because it was, so New Year's Eve against Montreal, Doug Yilmer arguably played his best game ever here, including games in the Stanley Cup against Montreal. Unbelievable game. And at the end of the game, I'm done. Goes back once again to arbitration. So he'd gone to arbitration the previous summer. It was really nasty because it actually went through the arbitration.
But you weren't the GM then.
I wasn't the GM.
Reiser
was. Yeah. So anyways, but it was a nasty arbitration. So never play here again. New Year's Eve, on the way out of the locker room, I'm done. See you later. I think he even took his skates with him out of the locker room that night. Finished.
Wow.
So there was opportunities to do a couple of things. Do nothing would have been one thing. Best case scenario would have been a one-to-one trade for somewhere for another really good player, and that almost happened. And I won't mention the player's name, but it would have been an equal player coming back.
Who was it? Parks wants to know.
Yeah.
Well, he's. If I told you he's the current GM of the Anaheim Ducks, would you figure it out?
I might be able to.
Yeah. No. I'll do some research.
Yeah. Anyway, so it just kind of snowballed and unfortunate. There was also a lot going on, you know, with I think when I took over, the dollar was at 67 cents. So there was a lot going on financially with the team, et cetera, that people didn't know about. And the owners were great, but reality was the reality, you know. So, as I said earlier, you start looking to get empty seats, whatever type of, to figure out how much money you're making. You know, it's funny that we're talking about this because this is pre-cap, right? So pre-cap here was a budget. So now I laugh at the cap now. You know, I particularly laugh at the fact that every team has to spend at least up to $16 million below what the cap is. So if the cap goes to $100 million, every team's got to spend $84 million U.S. to get to the floor. So back then we had a budget given to us by the ownership based on what revenues were going to be. Which is,
and you could argue that too, right? Or they just said this is what you're working with, and that's how it goes.
You can be in the you're going to be in the meetings.
Yeah.
When they determine what the projected revenues are going to be, ticket sales, signage, sponsorship, et cetera, how much money we're going to make in terms of revenue, and what percentage of that we're going to devote to team cap or team salaries, along with your farm team, you know, had to factor into that also. So. Anyway, so we had a budget, and I know from my time, I worked really hard to try to stay on budget.
Yeah.
And anyways, enough said on the topic.
It's tough, you know, back in the day when you're working on a budget, especially the Canadian-U.S. dollar thing, because a lot of guys were in Canadian dollars, but we had some guys brought from the U.S. that were in U.S. dollars. And then when guys got traded, you went from U.S. dollar to Canadian dollar, or Canadian to U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
So if you're making you know, 100 grand.
30% more.
Yeah, 100 grand Canadian. You are now making 100 grand U.S. Yeah. But vice versa, when the guy came from the U.S. making 100 grand, now he's making 130 grand
yeah.
Canadian.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it might not seem like a lot for people, but it makes a big difference, especially well, when you then, start. You know.
And then if you couple that with the fact that depending where the guy got traded to, which we hear about every single day now, about the tax-free states, right? Now you take your, to use your example, you take your 100 grand and you get traded to Dallas.
Yeah.
Tax-free state,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now you've got your U.S. exchange, plus you're not paying state income tax. So it's a big swing.
No kidding.
Huge.
I remember when I was in Dallas that the team was in receivership, or not receivership, but the owner had to sell the team. The NHL took it over, so we ended up getting physical pay stubs, right, in the stalls as opposed to direct deposit. And I remember getting off the ice one practice because it was sitting in the sub, and I bolt off the ice, and Dave Tippett's like, "Where do you think you're going?" I'm like, "I'm going to the bank before Modano and Zubov and Turco, so I can cash my league minimum check." Right?
Yeah. I didn't know you were that smart.
No, neither did I.
That's actually really fast.
Or that fast, actually.
You must have been really quick. Yeah. Zubov can really fly.
He was good, and he loved his darts too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there was another one.
Yeah, he was phenomenal. He was absolutely phenomenal. So, Pat, is there anything you want to touch on further with the Flames, or do you want to move on to Anaheim real quick, and then we can get into...
Well, I think, you know, the end of when you're with the Flames. How did that happen? What happens? You know?
Well, yeah. Did you have to go to arbitration?
Remember the joke I just told the guy here a couple hours ago?
Like,
I'll say it on the air. Some guy says, you still with the Flames? I said, no, I left. He said, why did you leave? I said, I left for medical reasons. The owners were sick of me. I talked about this a little bit earlier, like, and Doug was in Detroit also when I was there. You know, marketing can be a real devil in this business. And it can be a devil in drafting. Somebody will say, well, if the guy's almost as good from Red Deer, and we can sell some tickets because of that. Let's take that guy in the draft. And there's nothing sells more tickets and sponsors than winning. So draft the best player. Doesn't matter where he's from. You know, but marketing also plays a role in whether somebody's tenure is a little bit longer or it's shorter. Because if revenue start to fall off and you get some disgruntled fans and the media starts to go to work, whatever type of thing, you might as well go home and kiss your wife goodbye and say, we're out.
Yeah.
You know, we're probably gone here. So, I mean, we got, what did I get, about a little over four years and thought we needed one more year, you know, for some of those young guys. All those young guys were just starting. Like Regier and Derek Morris and Savard and Marty St. Louis was another one here. And so we had a really good young team that just needed maybe another year. And we needed a little bit better. We needed better goaltending, even my last year here. So anyway, so it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. But what about the Theo trade? Let's talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so again... Some of the great things that happened to this franchise were because eventually you go back to Noondyke. Noondyke's not going to play for us anymore. Atlanta Ginla. Well, Fleury, we tried desperately to sign Fleury.
Yeah.
And I was the one talking to the late Don Baisley. Wonderful guy, by the way. The late Don Baisley, Theo's agent. And on a regular basis. And they had pretty much made up their mind that they were going to test unrestricted free agency. And what had happened the year before was the age of young unrestricted free agency reduced by a year, and it was right on his birthday by one day. And so it went from 31 to 30, and his birthday, I think, is on the 29th of June or whatever, something like that. So we lost a year in free agency, so one more year. But anyway, so we made him a kind of a final offer. Or I did, and it was rejected, and Don just said, like, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what you offer. We're going to test free agency. So you had a decision to make, and obviously it's a decision you're going to talk with the owners about. I had a discussion with the owners about it. I said, in my good conscience, in my role here, I can't see us losing an asset like this for nothing, letting him just walk away. And one of them says, well, what if he helps us make the playoffs? I said, well, he might, and we might not make it anyway. And so if we don't make it, and I haven't made this move somewhere with him, whatever, we have nothing for this player. So anyways, go ahead and the late Pierre Lacroix called me one day and said he was coming up actually for the CHL Prospects game that was in Calgary. And he says, I want to talk to you when I get up there. I says, sure. So we sit down and he says, what do you want for Fleury? So he initiated it. And I think that probably because Joe had played with him, Sakic, I mean, let's face it, he was a great player. Yeah. Fleury was an unbelievably great player. And so they were one of the teams back then that were willing to make a big move to try to win the cup. They already had a great team. Add one more piece like that, and we can potentially win another cup. Well, that part didn't work out, but anyways, we end up making the deal. It was crazy, the deal, because so we end up trading him for, they had two first round picks that year, both defensemen. One was Robin Brigier and the other one was Martin Skula. So they were both really good players. Martin Skula was a real good player in the Ontario Hockey League. They're both left-hand shot guys. Brigier, of course, a Western guy. And so I made the deal with him. Well, we got the deal got a little bit bigger, but the key part of the deal was, again, the young guy was the prospect. So I made the deal with him that I had 30 days. I had both of them, and I had 30 days to decide which one I wanted. And so he said, what do you mean? I said, I'm not making a mistake on this. And I trust our scouts, but I want to go look at these players myself. So I did. I went and watched Skula play four games, and I went and watched Regier play four games, talked to the scouts. They were always in the Regier camp anyways. And after watching him up in Prince George for two games playing for Kamloops. No. Yeah, Kamloops.
Kamloops.
Yeah. So I called Pierre back, and then we switched also Dingman for Wade Bielak to get a little tougher on the back end. And the deal was done. But part of the deal was, though, that I was to get their first-round pick, or we were supposed to get their first-round pick if they didn't re-sign him. And he wouldn't do that. So he said, I'll give you a second-round pick if we don't re-sign him. Well, the second-round pick turned out to be what they called a compensatory draft pick. If you lost a free agent, you got a pick in the draft. Well, the pick in the draft was a second-round pick, because it was based on the value of the player signing somewhere else, which was $49 million from New York Rangers. So anyway, second-round pick in the draft and called the compensatory pick, and that was Jarrett Stoll. And then he didn't get signed, and Edmonton drafted Stoll in a redraft, yep. And Calgary drafted Lombardi, who didn't get signed by Edmonton. So anyway, so that was the deal. It was a piece of the building blocks, as we were talking about earlier. Big piece. Terrific player.
Yeah.
Alex Hemsky, I think, still has nightmares. We
played an alumni game up in Lloydminster 3 years ago, and Reggie was on the ice, and Alex was playing for Edmonton.
Yeah, it's too bad Reggie wasn't on the ice the first shift, the first 6 seconds when Alex Hemsky put one on top of your shoulder.
Put one right by my ears.
Yeah,
into bar the, down, first into shot.
The, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I got it back at the end.
I don't believe it.
Oh, believe it.
Yeah. Not with those ears.
No,
you're not putting,
no,
you're not
no,
putting anything
no,
by those
no,
ears.
No, they were tied back in the helmet. So now you kind of move on. You ended up in Anaheim as your next stop, right?
No, Rangers.
Rangers. Oh, right, Rangers. You ended up there. So you were in Hartford for a little while, right?
Yeah. So we, Glenn Sather was out in Edmonton. Well, really funny, because you know the relationship between Calgary and Edmonton, and I obviously knew him, because we were both GMs, both at meetings, this and that. But I mean, you used to go to Edmonton. This is stupid, but you used to go to Edmonton, and you see somebody from the other team coming down your sidewalk. Somebody went to the other sidewalk.
Right.
You know that's how bad it was. You know that because you guys lived in. Anyway, so as much as I knew him, I can't say that we were really friends. But when I don't think he was fired, but anyways, when they agreed to disagree up there, and I called him, and I said, sorry to see what happened. Whatever you decide to do, good luck, and hung up. So anyways, when I get let go down here, first call I got from anybody was Vetman. Second one was Don Cherry. Third one was Glenn Sather. And he says, I got something going here. I'll call you in a couple of weeks. So he was supposed to go to Minnesota. They thought he was going to Minnesota, the Wild, as their first GM. He had never intended to go there. And so he was going to New York. So when he got the job, he called me. He says, what are you doing? I'm waiting on phone calls, I guess. He said, why don't you come join me? So we packed up here and away we went.
Wow.
Yeah, they were so good. He and Ann were so good to Jane and I and our kids. Despite what everybody might, he is one wonderful human being.
That's
that
awesome.
Guy. Yeah, great, great people. So we were there for 3 years, and then the opportunity came up with Disney. And
yeah.
So that was a tough phone call for me to make.
I bet.
Back to Glenn to say, you know, like, hate to do this to you, but I got this chance to go back to the NHL and work for the Disney Corporation or Disney Company. So we're going to go.
What grapes did you?
Oh, he says, that's your first time. That's your first time. Until you've been fired 4 or 5 times, you're nobody. I appreciated him calling you. It's great, great, great people. That's what you like about the business, right? You know, like we've all been through things, different things, and some good, some not so good. But it's the people in the people in the game, people in the business that you care about. That's what makes it.
Who brought you to Anaheim?
So Brian, the late Brian Murray. I'm saying a lot of lates today.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
The late Brian Murray was the coach, and Disney wanted him to be the general manager. So there was an opening there, because the guy that was in Disney, it's different, you know, like you, because they're all over the world, right? So they have layers of titles. So there was no president there. The highest hockey title was senior vice president of hockey operations, general manager. That was Brian. Even though he didn't want to be, he wanted to coach. But they said to him, well, if you don't want to be the general manager, maybe we'll find a general manager. Maybe that general manager doesn't like you as the coach. What do you say now? So he says, well, I think I'll be general manager. So he took the general manager's job. Then when the senior VP of business operations left, he called me and asked me if I would be interested in that role. And we had actually, it's connections, right? We had lived together in Lillehammer in the Olympics for 10 days. Got to know each other real well. Real good guy. Really good. Brilliant hockey guy, Brian Murray. Brilliant hockey guy. So I looked at it. It was a little bit more money, but I really didn't want to move again. You know, we just moved from Calgary with Jane and the three kids to Connecticut. But anyway, we picked up and away we went. Part of the deal, though, was when I was interviewing, my final interview, you know, because I'd been in hockey and because I had been a GM here, they were worried from a business standpoint that I was just going to be another hockey guy, that I wasn't going to. So
it all comes back to Ryerson.
Yeah. So anyway, so in the final interview with a guy named Jay Rizzullo, who was head of Disney International World Resorts. That was his title. And then the CFO of Disney International was Jim Hunt. The two of them. Michael Eisner was still there, who we got to know and be friends with later. But anyway, I wasn't interviewing with him. It was the other two guys. So it says, well, Al, it says, tell me on a game night, what do you, like, what would your role be on a game night? And I knew why they asked me the question. I said, well, obviously, I'll be in all the suites, talking to our suite holders, club seat holders, probably be at the information desk, talking to people coming in about season tickets, growing the business.
Right? Perfect answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew what they,
well done.
They knew what they thought. I knew what they thought I was going to say.
Yeah.
But it was true, because Brian came to me, like, that's the year that with Jaguar standing on his head that we beat Detroit and knocked them out. in four straight. And Babcock was coaching, and anyways, Brian says to me, he says, "Why aren't you coming with us to Detroit?" I said, "No, I'm not going. My job is to stay here and be with this staff, these people." In fact, I took them all to the National to watch the first game went to triple overtime, if I'm not mistaken. Jaguar had 50-some shots. And anyways, so I thought, well, we'd be at the National for three periods, maybe part of a one overtime if we get lucky here. And we're at the National for three periods and three overtimes and then some type of thing waiting for to win the game. So anyways, we won the series four straight. So I'm standing outside the dressing room, Mike Babcock and Lauren Henning and Paul McLean. They're the coaching staff. And Brian says, "Come on in here. These guys want to see you." So during the course of the year, the building would be two-thirds full, you know, like blah, blah, you know, type of thing. So I go in the coach's office, and Mike Babcock says to me, he says, "What do you think?" I says, I am so confused here. I don't know what's going on here." He says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I've been here a week. We won a series four straight and the building's full. What's been the problem here?" So they got a big chuckle out of it. And then because of that, here we go about winning. We were up 17% in revenue the next year.
For sure.
You know, so yeah. And then I purposely said to the guys from Disney, I said, I'm not moving here. If you have any thoughts about selling this team, no, we're not going to sell the team. But the Angels, that they also own, they just won the World Series. Bingo, gone. And when we got to the seventh game of the Stanley Cup Finals in 2003 and got beat by New Jersey in Game 7 in New Jersey, about 2 weeks after that, get back home, phone rings. "We need you over at the conference center. Start to get put together what they call the pitch book." I said, "What's a pitch book?" "Well, it's the pitch book that we're going to use for selling the team." Oh, boy. Here we go. Oh, here we go again. So, anyways, all worked out because we stayed on after transitioning the team from Disney to the current owners, the Samuelis. Stayed on for three years and won another cup and then move back to God's country.
Okay, friends, there you have it. That is our conversation with Al Coates as we spread it out over 2 weeks on this program, the Cumming and Gillespie LLP Flames Alumni Chronicles, starting to wrap up this week. Thanks to Al Coates for joining us at the Garrison Pub, and of course, thanks to Brent Cron and to Colin Patterson. My name is Pat Steinberg. As we start to wrap up this week's episode, Cumming and Gillespie LLP, personal injury and medical malpractice lawyers committed to getting maximum compensation for the injured and their families, visit CummingGillespie.com, and we will speak to you on the next episode.